Today on Fox Talks Economics, has EU membership been an economic miracle? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week, we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, subscribe, follow us on Instagram as well. In 2004, 75 million people in 10 countries joined the EU. Their GDP per capita has grown dramatically in the last 20 years. But how much of that is due to EU membership? And how much would have happened anyway? Basil Grassi of Bocconi University is the author of a new paper that claims that joining the EU has created a miracle, in his words, for these countries. And he joins me now. Basil, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, Tim. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Let's do some history, first of all. Which countries joined the EU in 2004? What type of countries were they?
So the country that joined the EU in 2004 include the Baltic country, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and then Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and Slovenia, and also Malta and Cyprus. So that's about 75 million people, as you said. So, you know, a bit less than the size of Germany in terms of population. Before joining the EU, those countries were essentially post-Soviet economies. So in the early 90s, they went through a big transformation from a planned economy to kind of a market economy. They went through what is famously known, the shock therapy. Mm-hmm. And then after those decades of shock therapy and reforms, they end up in a country with a lot of imperfections, a lot of economic runs, and dysfunctional market economy, although they were moving toward this market-based economy.
Why might they think that joining the EU might change their economies for the better, or that might accelerate their growth?
This part of the EU enlargement was to accompany with a bunch of reform and institutional reform. And the reason why we are thinking that joining the EU and by reforming the institution will create an increasing growth was that, you know, because there is a bunch of long-lasting questions in economics about the role of institutions on economic growth that goes back at least to the work by Acemoglu, Johnson, and Robinson that try to show that institutions are the big important thing in fostering growth. So back then, joining the EU was the opportunity to build better institutions that will generate higher growth. And this is important to know if the EU was having such an effect, because there's some countries like India or China that are now in the middle income group that will soon face the challenge to move to the high income group. And then maybe that the EU experience, if the EU membership and the reform and the institutional transformation that was going with this enlargement, will be able to, you know, make those middle income country to a high income country.
Take us back to 2004. It seems like about a million years ago now. It was only 20 years ago, but it was before the financial crisis. It was before COVID. It was before a lot of changes. At that time, how optimistic were economists about this? Did they predict that these 10 countries would have strong GDP growth?
Oh, yes. Everyone was very optimistic about those prospects, not only from the institutional reform, but also for the possibility to do trade integration, for the possibility to create a stronger tie economically between the people. There's kind of an interesting anecdote is that the stock market in Vienna, in Austria, which was, you know, Austria was really at the heart of the European Union from Eastern European country, really went very high just around 2004. And actually, it went super high all the way from 2003 to 2007, reaching a peak at 2007. It went down a little bit with the financial crisis, but still at a very, you know, higher level than it was before. So really, not only the economists knew that what future growth would be generated, but also the more business-oriented people knew that there will be like tons of opportunity for their business and for the people of those countries.
It's important to remember that around that time, the ideal, the vision for that European project did involve this enlargement and that confidence that European integration would continue and would deliver those results.
Exactly. Yes, yes. And so 20 years after, that's in the time to see if this enlargement delivered the expectation we had about it.
So 20 years after, how strong has the GDP growth been in these 10 countries?
The GDP per capita in 2004 in the 10 countries were about 18,000 international US dollar. It is now in 2019 about 35,000. So that's almost double in the space of 20 years, right? And according to the World Bank, that's make those countries part of the high income group, whereas they were part of the middle income group before. So to put that in perspective, the level of GDP per capita in 2019 is about what was the EU 15 level in 2004. So we're kind of catching up with older European Union members.
Now, in the next few months, I'm due to visit Poland and Czechia as well. I looked it up, and in 2004, I also visited both of those countries. If 2004 me was to see 2024 Poland and Czechia, what differences would I notice?
I think you will notice a lot of difference, but if you're going now, you know, it's basically going to Germany.
Yeah.
You know, everything is kind of, you know, roads are clean. There is big cars and German cars on the streets.
Yes.
One other kind of important change that I can notice is that being part of the European Union allows a bunch of students, especially through the Erasmus program, to travel around the EU 15 Europe. You go now in Poland and then you meet someone, there is a high chance that that person has spent like a few months in another European country doing his studies. And that, I think, on top of generating income and increasing the standard of living, it was also making the people of those countries closer and more integrated with their Western European friends.
There are two EU anniversaries this year. It's 20 years since Desenlargement, but it is also 25 years since the launch of the euro. Listen to our episode, The Euro at 25, broadcast in February 2024, to hear Marco Buti and Giancarlo Corsetti of the European University Institute discuss the good times, the bad times, and the lessons learned for the single currency.
Okay, the headline results are very good, but we're interested in whether joining the EU caused those good things to happen. There isn't any counterfactual world in which these countries did not join the EU that we can compare with. So how can you estimate the causal impact of joining the EU?
Typically, when we try to estimate the effect of any policy on the institutional change, you have a treated group, which is the 10 countries that joined the EU. And then you usually need a control group. And the control group need to be not subject to the treatment, so not joining the EU, and have very similar characteristics than the treated country.
Mm.
So as you point out, there is no country that didn't join the EU, which was very similar to the country that joined the EU. So thanks to the evolution of causal evaluation in economics, there is now a technique called the synthetic control method that essentially builds a control group by taking an average of a bunch of other untreated countries, the donor pool of countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then by taking this average such that everything is very similar before the treatment period, so the dynamics of GDP per capita, for instance, is very similar. You can also condition on other characteristics like export share, manufacturer share, and things like that. Then the assumption is that, well, if you let time go and then compute this weighted average of those countries that didn't join the EU with the same weight, that will act as a control group for the treated union.
A fascinating method to be able to take 10% of this country and 15% of that country and add it together.
Yes,
to make
exactly.
Does it work though? How useful have synthetic controls been in other research?
So initially it was used to evaluate the effect of terrorism on GDP per capita in Spain.
Ah, yes.
So the idea was to take the Basque region that were subject to terrorism and then try to evaluate what is the effect of terrorism on GDP per capita. And then they use the same techniques using as donor pool the other region of Spain. And obviously they find kind of big negative impact. Recently also there is a bunch of work by Maurice Schlarek and co-author that have looked at the effect of electing a populist government. There's a big data set of all the different governments that had been elected, and they look at like populist versus non-populist, and they use this methodology. Like for each populist election event, they construct this synthetic control and they evaluate the effect. And they find also that after 5 years, you know, the big negative effect of electing populist government. There is a bunch of work also using this methodology to evaluate Brexit. Again, they find negative effect on GDP per capita. I think it's very useful, a case where we don't have, as you point out, a good control group. That's one way to build a control group out of units or untreated units that are still very different.
So using this method, how much of the growth in these 10 countries after 2004 is attributable to EU membership?
Once you use this technique on the 10 countries that joined the EU in 2004, you found that GDP per capita is $8,500 higher in those countries. If we believe this evaluation, the EU increased your GDP per capita by 33%. Another way to put it is that half of the increase in standard of living since 2004 is due to the EU. So this is gigantic. It's huge. You're taking a group of people of the size of Germany and you make them 33% richer. That's a very, very huge impact. And that's why I call it an economic miracle, because it is.
But we're taking all these 10 countries together, and they are very different countries. Is this driven by the success of places which really have changed dramatically, like Poland, or is it common to all of them?
Each country had, in general, a similar experience with some variety. So the big winner, just from the raw data, are really the Baltic country and Poland. So Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, Lithuania was the one that have catch up the most with the EU 15 countries, then Poland, Slovakia, and Hungary and Czech Republic, on average, they did pretty well. And Malta and Cyprus have their own particular example. Slovenia were on the same path as before. One interesting thing is that it also affects the ranking of those countries. So for instance, Hungary in 2004, GDP per capita was much higher than the GDP per capita of Poland. And it was also the richest part in the Eastern Bloc of the Soviet Union, or also the richer part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And now the GDP per capita of Hungary and Poland are about the same level. And if anything, now Poland is getting higher. So Poland was starting from more agricultural economy and Hungary was a bit more advanced economy in terms of their GDP per capita. That's completely of reverse. As you said, the effect is not uniformly widespread across all those countries. There is some internal dynamic, but the big winner are the Baltic countries, including Poland, is really the Baltic tiger, if you like.
Okay. Within this, what part of what components of GDP have been driving this growth?
So this is a very important question, because not only to know why GDP per capita and standard of living have been increasing, this is important to know why, because especially in the future, we might be facing new enlargement and we want to make sure that those enlargements are as successful as the 2004 one. So if you look at different components of GDP, especially the demand component, so that's include consumption, investment, government spending, import, export, you see that all those kind of measures have converged to a stable level quite rapidly. So around 2004, or a bit before, actually. And then when you dig a bit deeper and then you do this kind of growth decomposition exercise, so this is essentially you decompose the GDP growth into the contribution of factor of production, like capital and labor, and in the contribution of the TFP, the total factor productivity, which is essentially capturing everything else that are not measured with capital and labor, but also fundamental technological change. So once you do this growth accounting exercise, both for the EU 2004, for the 10 countries that joined the EU in 2004, and for the synthetic control, you find that the contribution of capital and labor is a bit higher thanks to the EU, but the big, big effect is the increase in TFP growth. So it looks like technology or this allocation of factor that will be reflecting in this total factor productivity as being the main driver of that. But now the level of TFP is about 90% of the level of the EU 15 TFP. So that's starting from a level more around 75 or 80%. So that's a big increase that keep closing the gap.
Tell me more about this EU 15, the countries that were already in the club in 2004. Did the 10 countries that joined the EU and benefited enormously, did that also benefit growth in the other 15?
First, it's important to remember that in the EU 15, those countries since 2004, they grow, right? Everyone become richer since 2004. If we apply the same methodology to try to see if this enlargement, here the treatment will be that those EU 15 countries are now part of a bigger union, it's hard to find any significant effect. So the baseline result is essentially not statistically different from zero, so meaning that the EU15 didn't lose statistically significantly. And then when you do a bunch of robustness checks, sometimes it's above, sometimes below. So it's very hard to know what are the effects. So there is two possibilities. Either there is almost zero effect, or the effect is so small that we can detect it with the data. So far, the conclusion is that the EU15 didn't suffer from that enlargement, while the 10 countries that joined in 2004 really benefit tremendously from this enlargement.
So we could roughly say that in 2004, that 15 and the new 10, they came from different worlds, economically speaking. As you say, the EU10 have grown pretty quickly now. Can we say that those 25 economies have now converged, or is there still a difference between them?
There is still quite a difference between them. You know, if you look at numbers in terms of GDP per capita, right, the current level of the two new members are about $36,000, whereas the average among the EU15 is more around 42. Still a big gap, but that gap is really reducing. Any theory of growth will tell you that this increase in growth will slow down even for those 10 new countries, right? They had the catching up period. Now they're getting closer to closing the gap, and those last gain will be the hardest, right? Although if you do this simple exercise of extrapolating from this growth rate, which you should not do, but if you do it, if Poland growing at the same rate that they are growing now, they will be soon a bigger economy than the British economy.
Thank you for that. We started off by talking about what the potential changes were, this story of institutions and reforms that meant that we might expect these economies could grow faster. Can, with the benefit of hindsight, can we attribute this impact that you've seen to particular EU institutions or policies?
So I think that's something where we need to do more research to understand which of the policy and the institutional change were the successful one in generating growth. And I think there is ways to do that. You know, for some reason, economists are obsessed about the US. So, you know, anything like that would have happened to the US, would have already 20 papers. But this is important to understand because we want to know if by applying that to new current candidate country, including Ukraine, if we were able to do that. So I think one important particularity of this enlargement wave was that the requirement to enter the EU were what we call the Copenhagen criterion, which were put together in the Maastricht Treaty. And those criteria are really explicit about what the country should do. You know, they should have a market-based economy. They should be able to have respect rule of law, respect human rights, respect minorities. They also have to be able to implement any EU law that have been passed in the EU before. So really catching up in terms of institution. And I feel that this conditionality on accession is part of the success of this enlargement. The deal was like, you make in place this reform, you catch up your institution with the EU institution, and then you can be part of the club. And then by this conditionality was really had, in my view, played a big role.
We know to be slightly suspicious of GDP per capita measures because the implicit assumption is that everybody shares the benefit. Has everybody inside these countries felt the benefit of EU membership, or have they become more unequal?
The inequality level was fairly low in those countries. You know, yes. Think of it was a Soviet economy in the late 90s, right? Mm-hmm. And the inequality have surely increased since then. I mean, if you look at Gini coefficient, for instance, for Poland, it went for kind of something like an index of 30 to something like an index of 20 out of 100. So that's really a big increase in inequality. But, and I think to your first question, I should answer, yes, everyone might benefit from that because even the bottom of the distribution of those countries have increased their GDP per capita. And part of that increase of income of the bottom of the distribution is probably also due to the EU. It's true that inequality have been increased. Richer have been becoming even richer, but poor people also have been becoming richer. So everyone got richer out of this policy. Sure, that's increased inequality, but that was beneficial for all.
But, Basil, you look at the polling data and you look at the results from the recent European elections, and there is a big rise in anti-EU sentiment, especially in these 2004 countries. Given your results, are the voters wrong to be feeling this way?
First, this kind of this rise of populism is not specific to the 10 new number. This is really going everywhere in your country, in my country, in France very recently, in the US or in India. It's going up everywhere. So I'm not so sure that this is specific to this enlargement. It's true that the platform of those populists in Eastern Europe are oriented toward anti-EU sentiment. But surprisingly, some of those populist governments are quite happy to receive EU funding. So there is kind of a recent paper by Thiemo Fetzer and some co-author of him that look at the effect of Brexit and the political cost of Brexit. The region that lose the most were the region that were voting the most for the Brexit. So yes, voters are wrong to feel that way.
As I mentioned, it is hard to describe to anyone who wasn't around at the time how much optimism that there was about the economic benefits of the EU. You know, that was the prevailing mood in the late 90s and the early 2000s. You call this growth a miracle, and you argue that it is the sort of economic growth that you just don't normally find. Should policymakers in the EU now shout louder about what's happened? Because you don't hear them calling it a miracle.
I think they should. There is no doubt that this is an economic miracle. Is this miracle due to the EU? That synthetic control evidence seems to be pointing that. So it's supposed to be a causal evaluation of that. If the EU had a strong effect on growth in GDP per capita of those countries, then the synthetic control, this reading of the data that the synthetic control is, will deliver the result it delivers, right? So this is kind of a sufficient condition, not a necessary condition. So I think policymakers should be much louder. And recently in May 2024, there was the 20-year anniversary of this enlargement. And you could say that Polish policymakers were quite loud about saying, look, we're very happy to be part of the EU. Many people in those countries do feel that way.
You've already said that it's dangerous to extrapolate, but I'm going to ask you to do it anyway, because that's my job. There are a number of countries that still want to join the EU for this next generation. Are they going to have an economic miracle as well?
As I said, it's very hard to extrapolate, and I think that's very hard to know. I think to make sure that those next enlargement waves are well managed, we should try to learn a bit more about the previous waves to figure out which part of policy and institutional change, what were well done and what was not well done. Should we adjust the enlargement process? But I think this is important to remember that knowing how much gain joining the EU there is, it's important because, you know, there's some people fighting for the right to join the EU. They know the costs. That's research on that result is trying to give them what would be the benefit of joining the EU.
Vasily, fascinating to see your research. Thank you very much for talking about it.
Thank you very much, Tim.
The paper is called The EU Miracle When 75 Million Reach High Income. It is discussion paper 19114 at CEPR. The author, you've just heard from him, Vasily Grassi.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Don't forget to rate and review us. And if you want more, why not follow Vox Dev Talks for weekly episodes focusing on economic development. Next week on Vox Talks, the economics of strategy.